I'm pondering that trick. What does it have to do about the quality of our attention? It means something.
It's a great exercise.
It's a great, if you hear me, raise your hand. Why does that work? Very intriguing. It doesn't translate outside Minnesota? What does it mean in Minnesota?
No, people might not respond the same.
Oh, because people are more polite here? That's the reputation.
When the sister says good morning, people respond.
Sometimes it
good morning.
Is. And sometimes it's not.
Even if they're out in the sentence, they still hear me.
I think it would translate.
What?
I think it would translate.
I think it might translate too. It's intriguing. Okay. Those cheeseheads are very smart. So I first, I mean that with all due respect. My friend who I talked about yesterday, who used to work for the federal government, who was randomly stamping documents, does this pass the may I live with ease test, or may you live with ease test? Was from Wisconsin. She's since retired and moved back to Madison. But when I first went to visit her in her office, she invited me down to D.C. to lead a stress reduction session at her government agency. And I walked into her office, and I don't know about Minneapolis, but Madison seems to be a place where many, many people, even though they leave, there's a strong sense of being rooted there and from there. And so she had a Wisconsin flag in her office and this cheesehead, you know what cheese is. I had no idea what that was. What's that? I've never seen anything like that before. Why does she have that rubber yellow thing in her government office? Finally, I said to her, what's that? That's a cheesehead. Very interesting. Okay.
You see a lot of people with Minnesota sheep tattoos here.
Minnesota sheep tattoos?
Shaped tattoos. People like to get the state tattooed visibly on their body.
All right. I'll take a more careful look. People's bodies and see what I can see. Very interesting. It's wonderful here, really. I haven't ventured onto the Skyway yet because everyone says they get lost and I'm lost anyway, you know. So, we're going to sit in just a few minutes. I'm going to skip over compassion for now and talk about it a little later, either today or this afternoon, tied to equanimity, so that we can do both of those together and talk just a little bit about sympathetic joy or appreciative joy before we do another sitting, where once again we won't necessarily change phrases or change the methodology, but we can bring in the flavor and the texture, the feeling of sympathetic joy, the felt sense of sympathetic joy as we do the practice. So sympathetic joy is the ability to actually feel happiness and the happiness of others, rather than feeling so threatened or distressed or dismayed when we see somebody doing well. And I think we know the beauty and the potency of that quality because we know what it's like when we receive it and when we don't. You know, something really good happens for you and some people are so happy for you and it feels so beautiful. It's such a tremendous thing. And other people, it's like they may smile, but you really get the feeling. It's like they're not that pleased that this great thing has happened for you, and it feels so terrible. It just is so distressing that they feel somehow harmed in a way by your good fortune. So we know the nature of that quality. And of these four, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, many teachers would actually say sympathetic joy tends to be the most difficult. It's not impossible by any means, But there are a lot of challenges to it. And one is, you know, for example, the sense that happiness is a limited commodity in this world, and the more someone else has, the less this will be for me. Or a kind of mistaken notion of permanence, like you have everything and you will forever. And I have nothing and I will forever. But nothing is forever. Right? Everything is changing all of the time. We live in a molten reality. It's coming and going. So fragile. So tentative in a way. And then as another challenge to sympathetic joy, there's this kind of funny state. It's a little hard to describe. But we almost have this sense that the prize, the praise, the good fortune is coming right toward me. And you reached out your hand and grabbed it. So it went to you instead. And if it hadn't gone to you, it definitely would have gone to me. Somebody just a little while earlier this morning stopped me in the car and mentioned my friend Sherry Maples, who's a meditation teacher in Thich Nhat Hanh's tradition, lives in Madison, Wisconsin. She'd been a police officer for, I don't know, 20 years or something there. And Sherry is a baseball fanatic. And I was visiting her once in Madison. She told me this story about, I'm not going to get all this right, but she has like a glove. She has her own glove. And she takes it to baseball games, so in case like some special fly ball lands or comes toward her, she can keep it. So she told me this story once when I was visiting her about taking another friend of hers to a baseball game. I think his first baseball game, and some extremely special fly ball was his hand to get it, and actually in that case it like fell away, so neither of them got it. But even worse would have been if he kept it, right? It's that feeling, it was coming right toward me, it was mine, it was meant to be mine, and you grabbed it, you took it away. And of course sometimes we are in direct competition with somebody. We've applied for the same job, we've applied for the same grant. If you get it, I don't. But an awful lot of the time, it's not like that. But we live as though it were just like that. You took it from me. And how illogical is that? Sometimes I tell a story about it. I teach a 7-day intensive loving kindness retreat, as I mentioned yesterday, in Barrie every year. And one year I was giving a talk on sympathetic joy, and I just use this example. I said, it's like you're in New York City, and it's Sunday morning, and you buy the New York Times, and you open it up to the book review section, and you open that up to the New York Times bestseller list. And you see that your friend's book has gotten on the New York Times bestseller list. And you think, ooh, should have been my book. That, as though the New York Times was like choosing between the two, you know? And if it hadn't been your book, it would have been my book, which deserves it so much more. So by the oddest of coincidences in that particular retreat, I had 3 different friends, each of whom had had a book on the New York Times bestseller list, and they each came up to me after the talk and they said, is that how you felt? On my book on the list? And I said, no way. It just came out of my mouth. I don't know what I said. You know, but it's that feeling, like it was meant to be mine, but you stole it. Right, it's completely illogical. And the consequence is that we feel very lonely because we're constantly in competition. And then we have strong cultural conditioning. As many of you know, when I, you know, so often teach them and I talk about how I feel this is really like a culture of disparagement. We're taught so strongly to feel better about ourselves by putting other people down. And my friend Sylvia Borstein and I were once, this was like a long time ago, we were teaching together in Barry, and we were at my house, and we were watching the television, we were watching the Winter Olympics, and this couple got up and danced on ice, you know, executed one of those intricate dances on ice, and then the commentator came on, and without even, like, pausing for a breath, he barked out, "Lacks artistry." And Sylvia and I were, like, rolling on the floor. It was like, these people just danced on ice. That's not easy. Could you take a moment and just say, before you, like, rip them apart so that we think about how discerning a fellow you are, right? Somebody told me, I quoted this last night to a friend, and I've never been able to source it, so I've never been able to use it, but somebody told me at any rate that when Auden, poet Auden, was doing theater criticism, when he was writing critiques, he wouldn't ever give something a bad review. If he didn't like it, he just wouldn't review it, because as he put it, art has enough enemies. So someone said it, but someday I'll find out how to actually quote it in print. But
who was it?
They say Auden.
Okay.
So, are you a researcher? Help me.
I have a cell phone.
Okay. She asked who it was, so I was saying, oh, maybe my answer is in sight. Didn't take it on.
I'll try.
Okay, thank you. You know, so there's such a strong cultural conditioning that we also have to challenge for the experience of sympathetic joy. Someone's happiness is not taking something from us in truth. It's hard to remember that. I come back to the Dalai Lama in his very homey kind of way, where he said once something like, this was a while ago, there were only 6 billion people in the world. He said, it only makes sense to feel happiness for the happiness of others, because then you increase your own chances of happiness 6 billion to 1. He said, those are very good odds. And I think about that. You don't have to spend any money. You don't even have to get dressed in the morning. You know, you feel happy for someone else, it's like you're there. So all of this is like bundled together in what's actually a pretty radical investigation of what our conditioning is, what we've been taught, what actually makes us happy. Is it that kind of... Isn't that an incredible phrase? It's a dog-eat-dog world, you know? It's like, dogs don't eat dogs. I don't know where it came from. But it's like, it's an unbelievable phrase. Like, you know, is that actually making us happy? And why wait? Right? Till it's falling apart and we're in crisis. Why not build that reservoir of strength, of happiness, of connection, of truth in an ordinary day? So we look at the quality of sympathetic joy and we stretch. Again, it's not trying to force yourself to feel something, you know, feel. It's not making believe. It's not being hypocritical. It's not being condemning of what, you know, when your jealousy arises or your envy. Remember, that's the knock at the door. It's relating in those ways with awareness, with balance, with compassion to all of those states. But it's also stretching. It's having that audacity to step out of the rut and looking at somebody with some success and thinking, may you be happy. May your success not diminish. Or even sometimes we ask ourselves, what would I get from watching it all fall apart for you? You know, we can investigate and actually just use the power of our attention to say, you know what, I have that habit, but it's so hollow, I don't need to be there. Let's try this. Okay, so that's bringing the force of sympathetic joy into the context of the loving kindness practice. So let's sit together. And remember, the basic bookends of loving kindness are to start with yourself and end with all beings, and we'll just keep playing with different combinations in the middle. So you can sit comfortably. Begin repeating those phrases, whatever they are, for yourself. Maybe it's a whole phrase, maybe it's a word. It's in the spirit of gift-giving. It's in the spirit of shifting our attention from being more consumed with what's wrong. To that sense of blessing. Thank you. One of the springboards for the experience of sympathetic joy is gratitude. Instead of fixating on what we don't have, we give a little air time to appreciating what we do have. So in this context of loving kindness for yourself, see what comes to mind, even just from today. What you can be grateful for. And see who comes to mind when you think about the people you see as playing some part in your being here in this room right now. This is the reflection we did Friday night. Because we're all here as a confluence of interactions and connections and conversations and relationships. people maybe are taking care of things at home right now, so you can be here. Some long ago, perhaps, told you about this organization or their own meditation practice or gave you a book or read you a poem. So, in some manner, so that it's either one by one or in a group, so you don't feel like this jumble. You can see who comes to mind and offer the phrases of loving kindness to them. And let's, again, do loving kindness for a friend who's doing well right now. Experiencing success or good fortune, you can bring them here. Get an image of them or say their name to yourself. Get a real and vital feeling of their presence. And offer the phrases of loving kindness to them. And a friend who's not doing so well right now. Because that is also part of the truth of life. Bring them here. And offer the phrases of loving kindness to them. and everybody here, including yourself. And all beings everywhere. So since we have these bodhisattvas of microphones who are willing to run around with them, this might be a good time to see if you have any questions or comments, anything you'd like to talk about. But I don't know where they are.
I've never really had this experience with this drowsiness before, and when I've been doing the loving kindness this weekend, I shifted it to doing, may I be filled with loving kindness, you know, that kind of more, that it has more of a rhythm. Mm-hmm. May I be well, may I be peaceful, may I be happy. And I'm wondering if that takes away from the heart energy that's being created here.
No, I think that's beautiful. And I mean, the basic thing about the phrases is that it's good if they're pretty general, so that, you know, as we talked about, you can offer them to yourself and reasonably offer them to others, so that you're not stuck with some shift in the recipient thinking, what about you? You know, which could go on for a really long time and be pretty scattered. And that means they need to be kind of general. And it needs to work for you in some ways. That sounds great.
I don't need it. Yeah. I wouldn't.
Okay.
Yeah.
When I was out on the walking meditation, I saw a car that had a magnet sticker on it with a quote from the Buddha about we become the words we say, or, you know, thoughts to that effect. And so I'm wondering how you think about using more not future statements, not gift of the future statement, but as opposed to may I be happy, I am happy. Mm-hmm. As opposed to may I be safe, I am safe. Those kinds of positive statements in the moment, mm-hmm. and how that might affect the bigger picture of the meditation practice.
Mm-hmm. I actually don't tend to think of may I be happy, may I be safe as future oriented. I see it as very immediate gift giving. You know, if we're going to pay attention to something in this moment, it could be the really stupid thing I said at the meeting, which maybe needs some attention, but maybe not our exclusive attention. Or it could be this sense of, may I be well, you know, may I be filled with loving kindness. But I don't really see it as future oriented. I also think that I've never really seriously done an affirmation practice, like I am happy, I am peaceful. I think it's different than the loving kindness. So I can't speak from the inside because I've never done it. But I am, you know, as I've described myself, I'm like a New Yorker, right? And so my first thought is, well, actually, I'm not that happy. You know, like, what do you mean I'm happy? You know, so I wouldn't say that. Maybe that's the reason I've never done it. Well, maybe that's the reason to do it. I don't know. But I actually think it's different. It's not an assertion I'm happy or I'm peaceful or I'm filled with loving kindness, although that no doubt has its own effect, you know, and if one undertakes that as a practice. But it is very much a practice of generosity, so I always come back to that. It's like generosity of the spirit. We're giving ourselves a gift rather than berating ourselves one more time right now. We're giving ourselves that gift of, you know, may I be well, may you be well. And it also works because remember that we don't only offer this loving kindness to ourselves. That's like the foundation for that offering to others. So I don't even know what you would say if you're going another track in making that offering to others. You know, I have to kind of try to think that through.
I have a question of sorrow. I often think about the suffering of animals. Mm-hmm. And I'm overcome with sorrow, and it happens daily. It happens daily, and the images come in my mind. And, you know, it's true, nothing lasts forever, but the suffering that animals have, you know, at the hands of people, and I try to direct my feelings towards the people who hurt the animals is the only way I can do it. And can you advise me what to do about this suffering and sorrow?
Sounds like you're doing pretty well, right? when you said you direct the loving kindness toward the people who are harming, I mean, that's an amazing thing right there, right? There is plenty of sorrow in this world. There's no doubt about it. And as I don't know if you were there Friday night when I was talking about my book. Well, I was talking about the title of my book, Real Happiness. And I said, as soon as I went on tour with that book, I knew. I mean, it's a wonderful title, and it was also a title given to me by the publisher. So I knew it was going to be trouble. And as soon as I went on tour with the book, there was a lot of that. Almost every city I went to, somebody would come up to me and say, well, haven't you ever seen the bumper sticker? If you're not depressed, you're not paying attention. And I'd say, well, yeah, I have actually seen it. And not only that, they talked about it in the last city I was in. And I understand it. You know, and we'll talk much more about this. We are so conditioned to, when it's our own difficulty or pain, to feel ashamed, to feel isolated, to feel something's gone wrong, we've lost control of something we should be in control of. And when it's someone else's suffering, we are so conditioned in many ways to just want them to go away so we don't have to look at it, or to look the other way, or call it something else, or whatever it might be. It is very difficult to sit and be with an open heart, the immensity of pain that exists in this world. But we can actually be different with it, so that when it's our own difficulty or pain, we don't necessarily have to hold it with such a sense of isolation, but much more of a sense of community. And this, in many ways, is the basis of compassion. When I said it's our vulnerability that is the springboard for compassion, it's not imagining that we all suffer to the same degree, because clearly we don't. But the truth of life for every single one of us is that any one of us can pick up our cell phones and check the messages, and we might have a different life than the one we had when we first picked up that phone. You know, life turns on a dime, and that's true. So that kind of vulnerability, insecurity, uncertainty, that should bring us closer to one another. We should feel more connected to one another, because that's something we share. And we can learn that. You know, that's like unlearning the conditioning, or learning to see the conditioning of isolation, and seeing it in the moment, relinquishing it, and that stretch. It's that movement of inclusion, rather than being locked into that self and other and us and them situation. And when we look at the suffering of others, it also needs to be, I'm not suggesting you will never get overwhelmed, or one never gets overwhelmed, because we do, but if that's our regular state, then we also tend not to have enough energy to really try to do something about anything. You know, because it's so draining and so devastating to be in that state of perpetual overwhelm. And so that's where some of the practice and the development of what we call equanimity comes in, which is balance. You know, it's not that it all becomes pretty, it's not. But we have a way of relating, so even though we might feel the pain of it, it's not so consuming of us, so that we have more strength and energy to actually try to make a change.
Just a quick comment on that affirmation, but then I have a question. And that was just today, it popped into my head while I was walking, that I am safe, but I don't feel safe. And so my phrase became, may I know the safety I abide in.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was there, but also recognizing it was a struggle.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, my question is, in the picking the subject of the meditation, the mentor has sometimes been a problem for me in not recognizing all of the influences in my life. And so I'll pick someone. And then I think, oh, but that person too. Yeah. Oh, that person too. Yeah. And I do that with the brand. I do that with everything else. And that's a lot of my busy mind, that it just wants to jump, and I don't want to leave anyone out. Is that a detraction from the depth of the feeling? Or is it just the way my mind does this meditation?
First, in terms of the first part, I'm trying to think. There was a neuroscientist friend, I can't remember which one, who suggested making that switch from may I be safe to may I feel safe for some neuroscientific reason, and I can't remember that either. But that's a good thing, you know, for the phrases to kind of move, you know, and shift in a way that seems right to you. So basically, in answer to the, or in response to the second part of your question, it has to do with the question of balance, always. So the general rule is that the simpler things are, the deeper concentration will grow. Somebody once said to me, I can't remember all my phrases. So I said, well, how many do you have? And they said, oh, about 15. And I said, no one can remember 15 phrases, right? So we have a certain sense of, okay, maybe it's two, maybe it's three, maybe it's four, maybe it's five, but it's not a whole lot more. If you have one benefactor for a while, it could be one session, it could be a month, whatever it is, that will tend to deepen the concentration. So that's that side of things. And one friend, you know, like in each category. And by the way, you're very lucky to have many benefactors and friends. The other side is that we don't want the practice to just be dead or rote. It needs to have a kind of aliveness to it. So that might come from actually shifting to a new benefactor, even within a session. But for certain kinds of minds, or at certain times, that might be too jumbled. It's like too fast. And there's a much greater sense of settledness with one. You're not really leaving others out because you're, you know, you'll include them in some other way. Sometimes we actually say at the end of a session, okay, now have a party. Bring in all the benefactors that you didn't have time for, all the friends you didn't have time for, before we move on to all beings and so on. And, you know, there are just ways of doing it so that it doesn't feel like you're excluding. In any way, it's the change in your heart as well, even if you're just then recollecting somebody rather than being so casual, like, oh, well, never mind, you didn't do that much for me. You know, it's like that in itself is a beautiful thing, you know, even if you don't go the whole route to, you know, all the extensive phrases and things like that. So I would say it's a balance, and you also have to feel where your balance lies. And as I keep describing my own practice, and I keep saying that for me, being simpler, having the structure, not having 15 phrases, not having 15 benefactors is a big help. Because it really helps me deepen the concentration and not be so lost in the tendency to kind of digress endlessly. You know, but that may be different for you.
Hi.
Where are you?
Right here. I'm just wondering, as you're going along with the different phrases, there are times in different sessions where something will come up and I'll come to an awareness or a recognition of a pattern or something that's tight. Or so there's the inclination to then want to go a little more into the analytical meditation, but not sure if I should do that. Can you speak a little bit to that, of when, you know, if you're in a session or you move on to the next session, where you start to work with loosening maybe some of the things that you're recognizing in the loving kindness practice?
Again, I think, you know, it's a question of your own sense of balance. Many things will arise, and sometimes they are profound and interesting and worth deconstructing in some way. So when I, you know, said, like, if we look at anger, maybe we see an awful lot of sadness in there if we just look at it and hang out with it, which is one way of doing that kind of analysis. It's not obviously the only way of doing it, but it's one way of hanging in there with the feeling and paying attention to it and seeing what it's made of and its component parts and so on. And that is a really important thing to do. Again, it just depends, you know, on whether you find you're actually tending to do that or you're just going. In which case, it would be probably better, at least for a period of time, to strengthen that container of concentration. So we joke sometimes and we say this is like a typical 5 or 10 or 15 minutes in a meditator's mind. It's like you're sitting and you're thinking, well, first you're just doing the practice, you know, you're with the breath or you're with whatever, and you're in the moment with it, and then you think, I wonder what's for lunch. And you think, you know, lunch yesterday was really kind of interesting. It was late, of course, but it was really pretty interesting. You know, maybe I should be a vegetarian. That would be an awfully good thing, because, you know, it would be good for my health, it would be more consonant with my values, and it's better for the planet, I hear, so, okay, now I'm a vegetarian. And then you think, you know, it's hard to be a vegetarian, even in the most progressive city in the country, because, you know, you can't always get good vegetarian food in every restaurant. You end up just eating baked potatoes, basically, which is not that good. So I really better learn how to cook. And then you think, I wonder what time this ends, because maybe as soon as it ends, I can dash right out to the bookstore and I can buy a whole bunch of vegetarian cookbooks. And then you think, well, I'm in the bookstore. I think I'll go to the travel section because I really have to start planning my next vacation. And, you know, maybe I should go to Canada or maybe I should go to Mexico. Or I know, now I meditate and I'm a vegetarian. I'll go to India. And, you know, we kind of wake up walking down the streets of New Delhi and we think, how'd I get there? Because the last thing we remember thinking is, I wonder what's for lunch. Right? But we just subsumed in this chain of association. And that, it happens all the time. And so it's not like we're trying to destroy that capacity, you know, to think and associate, but we want to know what we're feeling as we're feeling it. We want to know what we're thinking as we're thinking it, because that was fairly innocuous, but clearly so many of those runs are anxiety-driven. They're painful. They're tying all kinds of psychic knots. We're getting incredibly stressed just from the machination of our minds. And, you know, so we want to be able to shine the light of awareness on whatever is actually happening in the moment. And one of the engines for that is that force of concentration, being able to settle on an experience as it's actually happening. And then we broaden that into a much more open kind of awareness. So if you have a strong tendency toward that, then that might be a signal. That's good feedback. You know, maybe when something arises other than my chosen object, unless it's very strong and insistent, I'm going to let it go for now and just come back to the object. But this isn't necessarily the choice you'll make, but, you know, that would be one option. Or you might find that it is strong and insistent, and you say, okay, I'm going to let go for now of that primary object, and I'm just going to focus on that emotion or reaction or thought pattern, whatever it might be. But also with a kind of recognition that you don't want to end up in India necessarily, you know, and so it's using those skills to actually be paying attention rather than being immersed.
Right here.
Yeah.
Hi. I was wondering if you would mind to address again something that you spoke about this morning. It may have been a quote that had to do with visitors and the suffering and the brightening of the mind because of that.
Mm-hmm. The quote from the Buddha is something like, "The mind is naturally radiant and pure. The mind is shining. It's because of visiting forces that we suffer. Forces like greed, anger, fear, and so on." So as I said, the reason I have liked that image so much is because of the sense, first of all, of these forces just visiting, and the growing realization I've had through my practice that I don't have to freak out every time they arise. Because first of all, and this is a key point, very much from one of my teachers, this man named Manindra, who said to me over and over again, because remember I was 18 when I went to India, and I was suffering mightily, but I didn't really have a very sophisticated sense of my emotional landscape or my inner life. And so everything was kind of shocking, and I was very judgmental. And so I remember sitting with Manindra somewhere and telling him what I was experiencing, and clearly I was relaying it in a way that had all that judgment implied in my tone of voice. And he said to me something like, "Why are you so upset about this thought that has come up in your mind? Did you invite it? Did you say at 3:15, I'd like to be filled with self-hatred, please?" But when conditions come together for something to arise, it will arise. So that doesn't mean we need to feel like we're helpless victims. In fact, that's the work, is transforming our relationship to what we're seeing, what we're knowing, what we're feeling. But the thought that somehow we get so good at this that it's never going to come up again, it's just like a misconception. That doesn't mean that we can't affect the conditions either. We do work with the conditions so that what might have been a kind of insistent, persistent, intense, nearly overwhelming pattern will start to appear with more transparency. It's not so solid. Maybe it doesn't come as frequently. But, we haven't failed if it comes. That's the point. Because our work is in how we're going to be with it. Not, and you think about how much time we blame ourselves. Like, I can't believe it. Why is this still here? It shouldn't be here. Or if anyone found out. When I wrote Loving Kindness, which was my first book, it was very funny because people started coming up to me and saying things like, "What does it feel like to never get angry? And what's it like to just be filled with love for everybody all the time?" And I was like, "I don't know." but that's the feeling. I shouldn't feel this. I shouldn't have this. And it doesn't help. It doesn't further things. So these forces are just visiting. They will visit. They're adventitious. They're not inherent to our being. They will visit. We don't know the frequency. We don't know how loud that knock's going to be. But we can develop the skills to relate differently as they arrive. And so then it's, all those like beautiful images in Tibetan teaching, like see the thoughts that come up in your mind like clouds moving through the sky, things like that. That's what it's all based on, is they'll come. But it's okay. It's not going to sort of fundamentally destroy a quality of presence and happiness we can have anyway. And then, you know, the other part of that sentence, the mind is naturally radiant and pure, it's because of visiting forces that we suffer. I always found very interesting, because it's not how we usually take it, right? We usually say, oh my God, like that was a disgusting thought. Or, I can't believe I still feel this, or whatever it is. And to make that shift consciously is actually one of the compassion practices. Instead of saying bad and wrong and terrible, to actually mentally translate that to, ooh, that's painful. Right? Or that's a state of suffering. We do that over and over and over again, and it really makes a very big difference. And of course, as we change that way of relating to our own situation, it changes how we view others, and we see the world more in the light of suffering and the end of suffering in that way.
So I have a question about you talk about these thoughts that get invited in, but there's the physical manifestation. When I meditate, I become aware of the fact that my heart feels contracted a lot. Mm-hmm. Sort of like a baseball. Mm-hmm. And what I've experienced today with the sitsu we've had, contraction through loving kindness for myself, which is always the hardest one for me, loving kindness for benefactors, and then when we got to the friend who's suffering, my heart relaxed. And then in the second sit, when you said, think of what you have to be grateful for. It just went, again, the sense that I have is it's holding in all of that gratitude. Is there a way to direct in meditation? Because it's not comfortable, it's not fun, it's not, I mean, it's suffering.
Yeah, it's suffering. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's the first thing, is to recognize that it's suffering, you know, and it's not necessarily this week's project to make it different or to break it open, but it is a state of tenderness and suffering and poignancy, and sometimes the thought that we have to make it different or the effort to make it different actually makes it worse, you know, because then it becomes like an enemy instead of something you want to surround with a certain environment, you know, of tenderness, and it's like you're holding a hurt, something, or I love that sense that you just expressed, like this is holding in something that's actually wanting to express itself and come out. So in a way, those two elements are going to do their own dance, and, you know, your conscious mind doesn't necessarily have to fix it. Because it will happen anyway, you know, it will evolve. But you also made me think of, oh gosh, it was like 93 or 94. And I was working on Loving Kindness, the book. And I didn't have a computer. I was very intimidated by the thought of a computer. Some of my friends did have computers, not everybody, but some did. And I kept thinking, like, it would be all they would ever talk about. Like at parties and things. And I think, why are they talking about that? And I thought I could never learn how to use one. In those days, cutting and pasting meant taking a pair of scissors, cutting, and you had some scotch tape, and you moved the paragraph around on the page till you figured out where you wanted to be, and then you taped it on. So that's how I was writing Loving Kindness. And a 94-year-old monk came to visit us at IMS from Sri Lanka. And first we had this small group meeting with him, and in the course of that meeting, he said that he was learning how to use a computer. So I thought, okay, he's 94. He can learn how to use a computer. Maybe I can too. And so that was my inspiration, and then I did. Then he said he wanted to go into the meditation hall. We had a course going on. And he said he wanted to go into the meditation hall and give a talk. So we thought, okay, you know, how long should we allot for the talk? Because he's 94, you know, he's not going to have that much energy. So we gave him like this little slot of time, and we went into the hall to hear him. And his meditation, it turned out, was a kind of loving kindness of the body, where he'd start May my head be happy. May my eyes be happy. May my ears be happy. And he just led us in that meditation. He was in the hall for about 4 hours. He had more energy than probably everybody in the whole room put together. And I kept thinking about that meditation and thinking maybe that's why he's 94.
Oh.
And he's still like as vibrant and learning and, you know, energized as he is. So that's also kind of an innovative, fun thing to do sometimes is, okay, may my heart be happy. And you don't have to center exclusively on that, you know, but include it, you know, for sure. And then this friend told me, back to my computer, he said, you just have to learn 7 things, you know, don't feel so intimidated, just learn 7 things. And honestly, I think I still only know 7 things, but it works. Yes.
It's really a simple question, and does the benefactor need to be in a living body?
It's actually not such a simple question.
Okay.
Does
it, people, there's
yeah, yeah.
lots of
yeah.
those who have inspired me are not necessarily in a living body.
Okay, does the benefactor need to be alive? I don't think they really need to be alive. Now I'll give you a traditional answer. There are different reasons people might do a kind of intensive focus on loving kindness meditation and different strands of result or benefit. One has to do just with concentration because we might be more wakeful, you know, as I've been describing, because for some people it's more interesting or inspiring than maybe another object like the breath. Not for everybody, but for some. Loving kindness is considered a very, very good exercise, even just to deepen concentration and all the benefits of concentration. More steadiness of attention, more steadfastness of attention, more power, because all that energy is being returned to us instead of being scattered all over the place. That kind of integration of our being, more wholeness as we gather all these disparate parts of our attention. So even just from the force of concentration, there are a lot of benefits. And certainly classically, it's taught that you can do any concentration practice to the point and through the point of attainment of very rarefied states of consciousness, very altered states of consciousness, which are called jhana. So the other benefit of loving kindness, the other great benefit of loving kindness is loving kindness. It's fearlessness, it's sense of connection. It's a very profound sense of connection. It's remembering to be grateful. You know, it's paying attention rather than ignoring. It's all those elements of loving kindness itself. So in the tradition they say that if you are doing loving kindness practice and your benefactor, say, is no longer alive, it's going to be
in the body.
It's good. Well, that's another point.
Yeah.
In that body.
Yes.
Then it's going to be harder to attain jhana. So that's the context. Like if you go to Burma for 3 months of intensive loving-kindness meditation, that's what you'll be told. But I think in reality, I don't know many people, if any, who do loving-kindness practice for the sake of jhana. We tend to do loving-kindness practice for the sake of loving-kindness and for some strengthening of our concentration, but not necessarily those rarefied states of consciousness. So that's part of why I say I actually don't think it matters, and it's a beautiful thing. Also, it's true in that very traditional context, which believes in rebirth, that person's somewhere. You know, and so there's not that sense of it's too late somehow. You know, so the very classical way that one would do that may be in the course of your regular loving kindness practice, and it or may not be, it would certainly be in the form of what's called sharing merit. So the word merit is the translation for this sense in the Buddhist teaching of almost a kind of moral force that when we do something toward the good, when we're kind, when we're generous, when we're restrained, like it would be awfully easy to tell a lie and we don't. When we sit down to meditate, even if it feels like our concentration is totally crummy, the fact that we sat down to do it, when we want to learn, when we question, when we come together in these ways, that's considered a very powerful act. It's generative of this force of goodness. And so classically, you don't come to a retreat like this, for example, and Sunday afternoon go home and think with a glee, "Ooh, I made a lot of merit." But the idea is to feel the power of that goodness and to share it, to dedicate it, to offer it. And so back, I guess, yesterday when I was talking about Burma and how on your birthday you don't expect to get gifts, you expect to give gifts. So if it's your birthday, maybe you'll go to the monastery and you'll offer food to as many people as you can afford to feed. And then after that, you'll share the merit with everyone who's helped you and all of that. And certainly if someone has died, you'll go to the monastery, you'll make an offering, and then you'll dedicate the merit of that act to the person who's died because it's believed that they are somewhere. They're journeying, or they're reborn, or whatever. And so it's not just a comforting act, although it is very comforting and consoling. It's actually considered to be a meaningful act. And that they say the most powerful, and of course, you know, I know, needless to say, not everybody believes this context, and you don't have to, but within that context, they say that the most powerful force for a continued relationship outside this body, outside time and space, is our own good-heartedness. So every time we do an act that is generative of that positive force, we can, if we want, actually dedicate the merit to those who've helped us. And so when I did a retreat with Saidu Pandita, my Burmese meditation teacher, in Barrie in 1984, when he came to teach for 3 months, and a friend of mine had died not too long before then, and when I talked to Upandita about that, he said, "Okay, now you have to do this retreat for both of you. And every day, at the end of the day, I want you to share your merit of the day, of having done that practice. Now you're practicing for both of you." And so it's like in that spirit that it's most commonly done. Were you wandering around the microphone? We have like...
I have one.
One minute.
Another question.
Okay, one more question, and then we're going to break for lunch.
My question was about the sympathetic joy. From my own experience of having practiced it, when I would choose somebody who I, a friend or associate who had good fortune, there seemed to be, very quickly, my mind would say, "Well, enough, you know. You've got your share of good fortune. I've wished you well." It was like, you know, how much of a good thing can I expect you to have? It seemed kind of unrealistic to continue to wish that person to be well. Could you comment on that?
I thought you were going to say something really different. Because we've known each other a long time, Edwin and I, and I was thinking something I hadn't said earlier was that actually some people have very natural sympathetic joy, which I find beautiful. And we probably know people like that. They just seem to have it. Something good happens for you and they're so happy for you. And for most of us, it's a training. It's not that automatic because we have all those assumptions about scarcity and competition, and they're so operative that we need to challenge those for the sympathetic joy to come forward. So as Edwin started speaking, I thought, oh, you're probably one of those people who has a really natural sympathetic joy. I said, I think you are like that, as I recall. So then you said something very different. So I was thinking, oh, maybe he's not. But I think he actually is. I think you are. Well, I mean, I think, first of all, it's very good to be able to laugh in our own minds. That's an extremely good thing. And that would be a moment where I would encourage that when you find yourself thinking, oh, it's kind of enough for you. Oh, it sounds different with an Australian accent. And also, sympathetic joy is what we're working with is our own resistance. So it's, in effect, I mean, if you were going to switch phrases to do sympathetic joy, it's more like, may your happiness and good fortune not diminish. Because what we so often do when we look at somebody doing well is you could lose quite a lot of that happiness and I'd be feeling better. You know? So that's what we're challenging, is that wish that it actually diminish or decrease. So that's kind of how it's working. And the rest, clearly, it's not in our hands, whether it increases or decreases or stays the same or whatever. That's the wisdom of equanimity. But that kind of corrosive sense of like, huh, you know, you didn't deserve to be on the New York Times bestseller list, or I hope the book falls rapidly, or, how'd you get in my way, you know, when it's like irrelevant, it's just not true. You know, that's what we're challenging, is those inner states.